today, a nightmare for the NHS as 1 in 50 people across England become infected with COVID-19. Tell me about your job.
I love my job, most days. Some days are harder than others, but I've been in the NHS now for about 10 years.
Dr. Samantha Batt-Rawdon is president of the Doctors Association UK and an intensive care doctor working in the southeast of England, where once again, she and her colleagues are under intense pressure, dealing with a massive surge in critical COVID-19 cases.
Things are quite tough at the moment. They're certainly getting tougher as each day goes on. It feels like we are where we were in, you know, March, April, except this time it's worse. The cases, you know, just seem to be going up exponentially, and you know, the number of patients that we are seeing with COVID is just, it's just overwhelming, and there's no end in sight this time. It's unlike anything I've experienced in my career.
What Samantha is describing is being repeated in hospital after hospital. It's why full lockdowns have been introduced across the UK, and why some fear the NHS could collapse within 21 days. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how COVID-19 became the biggest challenge the NHS has ever faced. Dennis Campbell, as health policy editor at The Guardian, you know the NHS inside out. What does Boris Johnson mean when he says it could collapse within 21 days?
Boris Johnson means that basically hospitals in particular will just not be able to do their job, will not be able to cope with the huge, huge ongoing spike in people who are seriously, seriously ill with COVID. Many hospitals are already beyond full. And he's talking about a scenario in which, on the current rate of escalating numbers, hospitals will simply have nowhere to put the people who need care and not the staff to look after them. That's a situation the NHS has never been in before.
And you obviously covered that first wave right through to the peak of it. What have we seen unfolding over the last few weeks, and how does it compare to then?
So the difference now is that all of the numbers are bigger and therefore worse. More infections daily, more hospitalisations daily, bigger numbers and bigger proportions of hospital beds and hospitals' overall capacity taken up with people whose life is in danger because they've got COVID-19. Crucially now, there's a very, very high staff sickness rate across the NHS, particularly in hospitals. The NHS's normal staff absence rate due to sickness is about 4% in normal times. It's running in many places between 8 and 12, and I've heard of it being as high as 15 or 16% in some other places. So if you've got two or three times the normal number of staff off, but more patients who are really critically ill in needing care, then that's the worst of all worlds.
And that's NHS England. What about the rest of the UK?
Extraordinary pressures on care and services and staff are being felt across the whole of the UK.
We cannot keep going in this direction, or our National Health Service will fall over. It will not be able to cope with what is going on.
Just a few weeks ago, the Health Service in Northern Ireland had to call for help, in effect, from their colleagues in the ambulance service across the border in the Republic of Ireland for the first time ever. Tents to treat people in and triage people in being put up in car parks outside hospitals. The health service in Wales and Scotland, all again under the same pressure, the staff under the same pressure as those in England.
I know that the next few weeks will be incredibly difficult. I'm sorry to ask for further sacrifices after 9 long months of them, but these sacrifices are necessary.
What are hospitals doing in response to this unprecedented demand?
They are all expanding their intensive care capacity as best they can.
We've done everything that we can to make some space and to try and know, look after patients as best we can. But what that means for us on the ground is turning places in the hospital that were never meant for critical care into places where ICU patients can be looked after. And even then, those areas are now full. So we've been trying to transfer patients out of the southeast, but as far as Yorkshire or the southwest, which is not normal and completely unprecedented. You would never, ever think about transferring a patient that far to try and find a bed.
As they did in the spring, they are increasingly repurposing staff, shifting staff from other areas, from internal medicine, elective surgery, A&E, any other areas of care where they have skills that are very useful in intensive care, critical care, and hoping that they can make up the numbers to give the patients who are in with COVID the best care possible.
We've got lots of people who have come to critical care, who've never worked in critical care before. Surgeons, we've got people from other specialties who are working with ICU nurses, obviously could never replace an ICU nurse. So we've got this sort of expanded army on the ground. So things are tough, but you know, it's slightly easier with a good team around you, I think.
The NHS said all over the summer, whenever the first wave had subsided, that come the second wave, they were going to do their absolute level best to keep elective surgery going, given the huge trouble that was caused by the widespread suspension of care in the spring, whenever people couldn't get heart operations, cancer operations, care for stroke, also a whole range of medical conditions. Sadly, unfortunately, the same thing is happening again day by day. There are more hospitals now coming out and having to cancel both elective surgery, kind of fairly normal stuff like a cataract removal, but also we've been reporting this week about how some hospitals, particularly in London, have had to cancel urgent cancer operations. Now, I've never heard of urgent operations having to be cancelled before. It's very, very rare, very unusual that that happens. But sadly, it's happening now because hospitals simply do not have the capacity to do both things at once.
And often with heartbreaking consequences. You and I spoke about cancer care back in the summer, Dennis, and you put me in touch with Sherwin Hall, who was just 28, spent months trying to get a scan for pain he was having. By the time he finally got it, the cancer was so aggressive that sadly we learned that he lost his life late last year. You must still be hearing stories like that.
I'm afraid I am. I wish I weren't, but let me just read you an email I got a couple of days ago from a Guardian reader who told me how his dad had been diagnosed with bowel cancer on the 8th of December after having had a colonoscopy and a CT scan. His dad was due to go into surgery at a hospital in Yorkshire on the 22nd of December, less than 2 weeks later, but he was sent home on the day after arriving in hospital because of a shortage of intensive care beds. His operation has been rescheduled for the 21st of January, but who knows whether it will go ahead. He said, in my dad's case, his cancer is described as large, but hasn't yet spread. But because of other health issues, chemotherapy would be very risky, which means if it doesn't get into surgery fairly soon, it will spread and become inoperable.
It's just so devastating that that care is being sidelined once again. But even COVID itself is forcing doctors to make difficult choices.
That's right. So I am hearing from doctors that hospitals are now, because of the circumstance, the horrendous circumstance they're facing, are in effect starting to ration care in two ways. First of all, patients with COVID have to be more sick to get into the hospital in the first place. I've heard of some hospitals where now in the spring, if your oxygen saturation levels had fallen as low as 93 or 94, you would definitely have got in. But now hospitals are now applying a 90. You have to, basically your oxygen sats have to be as low as 90 or under to get in, simply because they cannot deal with everyone and everything that's coming at them. And then the other more troubling thing, which has been speculated about and is a great source of ethical debate amongst doctors, is whether or not once people come in the hospital severely ill with COVID, are now some hospitals in effect informally rationing care. And again, one intensive care doctor in the Midlands tells me that in recent days, hospitals in the Midlands, London and also Greater Manchester are already now doing this. In other words, if older frailer people with underlying conditions are coming in whenever they are already, they've got pretty much every ICU bed already taken. They're putting those patients straight onto palliative care without offering them a spell in ITU first.
Do the NHS acknowledge this is happening?
The NHS don't acknowledge that this is happening, and there is no official national NHS-wide policy on this. This is now being done at the discretion of doctors and individual hospitals as a response to the circumstances they are in.
But what about the extra facilities that were built to try and deal with this? What happened to the Nightingales? Are they being used this time round?
So it's a mixed picture with the Nightingales. A few of them are being used, but certainly all of the great attention back in the spring was on the Nightingale in London, the first one to open. Prince Charles opened it. It was meant to be a 4,000-bed mega critical care unit. It was used for something only over 50 patients. There's a plan, apparently, to reopen it this week with about 300 beds. But the trouble with that Nightingale and the others is that there simply are not the staff in the NHS to provide this extra capacity that was planned whenever all the Nightingales were first created back in the spring. Whenever you've got a situation where hospitals were understaffed before the pandemic, the sickness and isolation from COVID is wiping out huge tiers of staff at the moment.
That is terrifying. And one hospital in East London has reportedly gone into disaster medicine mode. What does that mean?
This was the Royal London Hospital in London's East End. It emerged last week that senior managers had sent a memo round to some of the staff warning, quote, "We are now in disaster medicine mode. We're no longer providing high standard critical care because we cannot." That's what it said. Admirably candid, obviously not meant to be leaked to the media the way it was. But that is just a more honest, brutal expression of what doctors and hospital bosses tell me now pretty much every day, nurses as well, that they just cannot, in the current chaotic, ever more pressurised circumstances, they just cannot guarantee the quality of care that patients would normally get. And there are some reports of limited supply, oxygen supplies in hospitals to people receiving either mechanical ventilation or non-invasive ventilation because of the sheer numbers of patients requiring oxygen in certain hospitals, hospitals having to limit the amount of oxygen that they can have.
I mean, what impact is all of this having on the staff working inside intensive care units and in other parts of the hospitals?
So I got a message yesterday from a friend who's a doctor, a consultant working with COVID patients every day, every week in a major London hospital. I'm going to read it to you to give you an insight into how things are now. So there in intensive care, he said, the staff, particularly the nurses, have three times the workload as normal. In other words, they're now looking after three patients seriously ill with COVID compared to one normally very sick person in intensive care. These patients they're looking after have got double the morbidity and the mortality, i.e. the risk of dying and the fact of dying, compared to normal patients who require intensive care. And this is all happening to a specialty of staff, intensive care staff, who he says are the most highly trained, yet in his view, the most undervalued, underpaid, unvaccinated, and almost certainly have the highest rates of PTSD amongst the NHS workforce from dealing with the first wave of the pandemic.
Samantha, as an intensive care doctor, you're right on the front line. This must have taken its toll.
I don't think it's caught up with people yet. I don't think it's caught up with me yet. Certainly during the first wave, the end of the first wave and everything settled down, we started to see, you know, a considerable mental health burden, you know, amongst healthcare professionals. Certainly we saw that in our networks.
I was in intensive care for...
Can you describe what it's like treating COVID patients?
I don't know what happened with me.
So treating severe respiratory disease is our bread and butter in intensive care, very much what we used to...
I didn't believe that there was COVID. But now when I suffered, I do. I now know that there is COVID.
But with COVID, people have these critically low oxygen levels. And the problem is when you don't have enough oxygen, you feel this sense of euphoria. And they're sitting there and they're talking and they're smiling at you. And then, you know, you you x-ray them and you look at their lungs, and these x-rays are, I can't even describe, they are nothing like I've ever seen before. And you can just see, you know, the COVID in every lobe of their lungs, and you know that patient, their life's already under threat. And we know that it disproportionately affects the elderly and they're most at risk, but, you know, we would have young patients.
Many of the patients are noticeably younger than in the first wave. Zieko Savchev is 46. He came in 20 days ago and was in intensive care for 2 weeks.
I felt myself that I couldn't make it at some moment.
And patients who had never had anything wrong with them in their life, who were out running half marathons, who would come in and who would have no idea how low their oxygen levels were. And they would be fighting for their lives on a ventilator. And that's not normal. That's not something that, you know, we see often in critical care at all. And I think that's been one of the, you know, one of the hardest things about it, because you have the opportunity to form that relationship with patients, even though they're critically ill. And it's what we call in medicine is, unfortunately, the talk and die patients. And we know that that's what people find really hard. And that's certainly what I find really hard.
I admit that. I saw people around me that didn't make it at that time. And I believe that I was the first one for that 10 days that got discharged successfully.
How are you all coping?
Well, I run these big Facebook groups for doctors. So we've got about 49,000 doctors across our platforms. And it's been really, really hard to motivate people a second time around. You know, in the first wave, everyone was scared, everyone was worried, but everyone was really determined to muck in. And certainly I felt very proud to be able to use my skills to help at a time then that we were most needed. But then as the reality of the first wave hit, you know, the number of patients we were seeing, but also the number of colleagues that we lost, 650 healthcare workers who have died, and that very quickly dented the morale we had. This time around, although we all expected a second peak, this has just been so much worse. The number of patients we are seeing is going up so quickly, and, you know, we don't know when it's going to get better. All we know is that it's going to get a lot worse before it does get better.
Did you lose friends? Did you lose colleagues?
Yeah. So I've lost 3 colleagues. That's really hard. You know, all of them had children. You just can't, I can't even put into words how difficult that is.
Are you scared? Have you had COVID?
Am I scared for myself? Not really. I'm worried. I think it'd be fair to say that I'm worried. I've been lucky in that I've always had personal protective equipment, but, you know, seeing people get sick and die all around you, you do worry about what will happen. I think I probably did have COVID very early on in March. I was certainly, you know, if it wasn't COVID, it was flu. I lost a lot of weight, which I'm going to take as a win. But I just couldn't get out of bed for a week, so I've never had anything like it. So it might well have been, but I've not been offered an antibody test, so I don't know. But, you know, you just have to push that out of your mind, really. I think if you worried about what might happen if you got COVID, then I don't think you would be able to do your job properly and look after the patient in front of you.
Do you go to work with a sense of dread?
No, I wouldn't say a sense of dread. Sometimes a pit of anxiety. It's not sometimes. There's a pit of anxiety that sits in my stomach, definitely. And I think part of that is because I run this big organisation for doctors. So even if I'm not on the front line, even if I'm off, you know, I'm being emailed and texted by doctors, or I'm on the forums and I'm seeing what is happening in other places of the country. And, you know, doctors are coming to me and to us really, really distressed by what they are seeing and what they are being you know, asked to do, which they would never be asked to do if, you know, it wasn't a pandemic. So you can't really ever get away from it. I've tried to stop watching the news, I think, like most people, but it's just something we're all living with.
You know, there have been protests at hospital from people who don't believe this is happening. What would you say to them?
So I know about those protests because it was a colleague of mine who's a junior doctor in A&E. They were working on New Year's Eve and it was a really hard shift by all accounts. He was run off his feet and pretty broken by the end of it. And, you know, he came out and there were all these people outside of this busy London hospital with an ICU full to bursting of, you know, critically ill people. And there were people outside, I mean, hordes of people without masks on, shouting, COVID is a hoax, at staff that were coming out of this building where, you know, there were people who were sick and dying. And I'd love to say this is an isolated incident, but, you know, unfortunately, it's really not. NHS staff are unfortunately being abused. I mean, I had a message the other day saying, I don't care who's dying. And I honestly, I'm not going to read my inbox to you because it's so horrible. But it's just, you know, that's just really heartbreaking. You know, I don't see why people would think that NHS staff are lying. You can see it, you know, the pictures of the ambulances that are queuing to get into hospitals, they're real. They're real, and they've all got patients inside. And maybe part of this is that the comms are being centralised through NHS England, so it's hard to speak up in the NHS, but when you have organisations like mine, you know, you do have a role. You are able to amplify the voices of NHS staff, and I think doctors in particular, you know, they feel this real duty to get over how serious this is.
That is so shocking. And when you say centralised comms, are you saying that they're not letting stories get out there?
Yeah, so we saw this very early on. COVID's being handled as, you know, sort of level 4 major incident by NHS England, which is absolutely right. But part of that has meant that emails went out to all trusts saying that comms were being centralised through NHS England, and therefore, particularly in the early days, staff that tried to speak up were hauled into disciplinary meetings. And we know this because we supported a lot of those doctors at the Doctors Association UK.
Coming up, has austerity made it harder for the NHS to cope with COVID-19? Dennis, is it the case that years of underinvestment have left the NHS struggling to cope with this?
This is very important, and let's not beat about the bush. If you look at any reputable survey that is done, for example, by the OECD about the amount of health resources that Western industrialised nations have, Britain, the NHS, comes at best in the middle of the league table and very often very worryingly near the bottom of the league table for the numbers of doctors per head of population, the number of nurses per head of population, and the similar story for hospital beds, ventilators, critical care beds, all of the critical resources that you need to run a health service, particularly in the sort of crisis mode the NHS is now in, we have much, much less of. As the fifth or sixth richest nation in the world, I am staggered that this has been tolerated for so long. The current government has increased the amount of money going into the NHS, and that's great. But the historic underfunding, the impact of that is now felt on an hourly, daily basis in hospitals across the land. And anyone in the NHS will tell you that. The IT is rubbish. There aren't enough beds. There aren't enough staff. I'm amazed as a nation we put up with this.
You've covered health for more than 10 years. How bad is this? How bad could it get? And what do you think it means for the future of the NHS?
So the NHS is already in a place it's never been before. People use words like, you know, the NHS becoming overwhelmed and the NHS falling over. It's already happening. So anyone who doesn't think that is kidding themselves on. Hospitals and entire areas of the country, the health systems in entire parts of England at least, are already falling over and overwhelmed. It's obvious to me from talking to staff in recent weeks, the staff at the sharp end of this latest wave are doing an incredible job in horrendous circumstances, displaying the usual dedication to their patients, their colleagues, maybe even more than usual, going the extra mile, working unpaid overtime as ever, kind of the invisible axle grease of the NHS. And, you know, coming in, giving up their Christmas or New Year holiday, answering calls of distress, basically from their employers, hospital trusts, to say, we need some extra bodies on the ground. Can you come and help us? So all of that's been going on. Staff doing their very, very best in really, really difficult circumstances. I spoke to a chief executive yesterday and I said, are all these cases at the moment, are you all now so hugely under the cosh because of Christmas? And he said, oh, no. The Christmas impact from all the Christmas mixing, that's yet to come. That will probably be this weekend. And I said, given that your hospital and many of the others already almost at full stretch have gone beyond super surge, if you like, what will the plan be? And he said, I don't know.
What would you like to see happen?
I'm glad we've gone into lockdown, definitely. What I'd like to know is that this lockdown is going to be the last one. You know, I don't think it's helpful for anybody to have these continual cycles of lockdown. And the experts said to us last time that we should have had a full lockdown and we shouldn't have come out as quickly as we did. And I think that was right, but that's not what happened. So this time, I just hope that if we're asking the public to once again make so many sacrifices to lock down for a third time, you know, I think we need to be clear that we've got a proper exit strategy and that the government's going to listen to the expert and not come out too early. And we see the cases rise again, only to lock down again. So that's what I'd really like to see.
Just one last question. Are you angry?
I'm not angry. It's just so frustrating when you're a frontline NHS worker and you can see things going wrong. When you're saying, you know, things are really bad on the front line, like, what are you doing? We need a plan. And nobody's listening, and it feels like you're just shouting into the void. That's so hard. So I'm not angry. I'm not angry. I'm just frustrated. And like many doctors, I'm upset because the amount of life that we've lost. And thinking, you know, we tried to speak up. We tried to say this early on, and just the thought that we could have saved more lives, you know, that's really hard to live with.
That was Samantha Batt-Rawdon, President of the Doctors Association UK and The Guardian's health policy editor Dennis Campbell. Samantha has written a comment piece about this for The Guardian. Do go to the website to read it, where you can also find Dennis's brilliant reporting. We did go to NHS England about this piece, and sources rebutted a number of suggestions, pointing out that the NHS had not run out of ICU beds anywhere in the country, and so there was no reason for patients to be triaged any differently. They pointed to statistics suggesting older patients over 60 and 70 made up a higher proportion of ICU patients in this wave so far compared to the first wave. And they highlighted significant advancements in care, including new treatments, suggesting it was untrue to claim that anyone was missing out on treatment. They also said they had been proactive in granting media access, including to The Guardian. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.